For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we're looking at resilience. Mick Dawson and blind veteran Steve Sparky Sparks discuss their grueling journey to row across the Pacific Ocean. Sarah Jane Douglas and Richard Fraser reveal the reconciliation that each of them found through walking and contemplation. Ed Caesar introduces us to The Moth and the Mountain, the extraordinary story of a World War I veteran who sought to climb Everest alone. And we return to Mick Dawson for the books of his life. That's all coming up on today's Read On. In 2009, former Royal Marines Mick Dawson and Chris Martin became the first men to row across the Pacific Ocean. Regular listeners may well remember that Mick came onto the show to discuss the book that he wrote about their epic adventure. At the time, Mick also told us about his plans to return to the Pacific, this time with blind veteran Steve Sparky Sparks. And I'm delighted to say that they're both here to tell us how it went and about Mick's new book, Never Leave a Man Behind, which he's written about the experience. I spoke to them just before Mick went into the RNIB studios to record the talking book version. So, before we hear firsthand about some of the perils that they faced, here's a clip.
It was August 17th, 2018. After 2 months at sea and having rowed close to 3,000 miles from Monterey Bay in California, we were almost within sight of our destination, Honolulu. I'm an experienced ocean rower, but my partner Steve, Sparky Sparks, was not only a complete novice, he was also blind. If we made it across, Sparky would become the first visually impaired person to row the Pacific. He would get an entry in the Guinness Book of World Records, and we'd also raise money for and awareness of the continuing plight of UK veterans who have slipped through the support network of every conflict from World War II to the present day. There was a lot riding on our little adventure. I wrote in the ship's log as a postscript to that day's entry. Hurricane Lane has formed well south of us, about 360 miles, and is currently tracking steadily west. Tongue in cheek, I finished the entry. Is there going to be an unexpected last-minute drama? 3 days later, I'd get the answer. Yes, there was going to be a last-minute drama, a potentially catastrophic one.
Never Leave a Man Behind, written by Mick Dawson, is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Basically, it's a story of the Cockleshell Endeavour, a project I set up effectively to help a couple of mates recovering veterans, one dealing with the effects of PTSD, and the other, an old mate who sadly lost his sight in service. The story of Never Leave a Man Behind is basically the story of the Cockleshell Endeavour and the things that we did, the adventures we had to help both those guys get back on track, really.
And the Cockleshell Endeavour refers to a heroic action during the Second World War carried out by the Royal Marines in little Cockleshell boats.
Yeah, cockles, actually. Yeah, the Cockleshell Heroes, famous for the raid on Bordeaux, on the transport ships in Bordeaux, up Frankton. And yeah, it's just a little aside to that. We're all former Royal Marines, and so we like that connection. The project began with a paddling expedition, which would ultimately be around the Falklands. So that connection was a natural one and a tribute to those guys. And then it evolved into, obviously, the ocean row across the Pacific with Sparky.
It's very much in that tradition of overcoming overwhelming odds and falling back on your resilience, which led to the success of the raid in World War II and the success of both those endeavours. And Sparky, you in 2018 became the first blind person to row across the Pacific.
Yes, indeed I did. At some expense, I might add. It wasn't the easiest thing I've ever done. But all praise to Mick for organising it. He's done an incredible job putting it together at such a short notice. But I've certainly done easier things in my life.
Well, this was the Great Pacific Race, which is 2,500 miles from Monterey Bay to Hawaii.
That's correct, yeah, Honolulu. And wasn't it a great sight when we rode into that harbour? Amazing. To be fair, the race, it all came about talking to Mick. I reconnected with Mick after many years. I sat in the pub in Rottingdon, basically, where most good exercises and operations start. And they came up with this great idea that we would do this Great Pacific race. Time, it was, I don't have a problem with that. Let's do it. So you go away, come back the next day, and everybody's remembered it. And everyone said, you're still going to do it. You're still going to do it. It's happening, mate. We're doing it. So I went away again, came back the third day, and I said, Mick, I've got one slight problem. And he went, what's that? I said, I've never rode before. And he said, well, don't worry about that, mate. You've got 2,500 miles to practice on. And I went, oh, good answer. So now I'm committed. And then it was like all focused on the event. And to be fair, it was nothing like I expected it to be. It was unbelievably hard than I thought it would have been. And purely because of the weather. I was told the seas would be warmer. It was the best time of the year to do it. And we actually had the worst weather recorded within a couple of, 100 years, I believe it was.
It's delayed 4 days.
So that was a bit nerve-wracking. When you've never been out on a rowing boat before, let alone in an ocean, it's quite an awesome thing to have to attempt. But when you've got somebody like Mick, and I'm not blowing smoke in the wrong direction, he just confides in you, puts you at ease. And when you've got probably the best ocean row on the planet rowing with you, there's not a lot to worry about, really. It was a great experience. I learned a lot from it. Do you know what? I'd probably do it again, if I'm honest. But nobody wants me to.
Well, Mick, would you take him across the Pacific in the other direction, maybe?
In a heartbeat, yeah. In a heartbeat, I'd go rowing again with Sparky. Hopefully we'd get better weather and we'd avoid the Category 5 hurricane at the end of that particular row. But no, there's no question about it. It was a lot tougher than anybody could have anticipated. But now it's over. That's made it twice the experience. It probably wasn't at the time for either of us, because it was as tough a row as I've had. And, I've had a few tough ones. But it did make it an even greater achievement to get across because of that.
And you won your category, didn't you?
We won our category and we came third overall. So it wasn't bad.
I was looking at your record of rowing the Atlantic and the Pacific, and the Pacific really has thrown the filthiest weather at you on many, many occasions. What is the lure of going back again and again?
it's difficult to describe. I mean, for me, initially it was the North Pacific, because nobody had ever done that. And then once you get out into the North Pacific, it is so huge. It's just vast, and it's as beautiful as it is hostile. It's as remote as it is in your face. And the wildlife is phenomenal. It's just a magical place. It's tough. There's no question about that. Every hour you're out there, it's hard work. But at any given moment, something incredible can happen. And, I always see it as a privilege to be out there. I always described it as it's like having the best seats at the best show in town, but the price for the tickets is quite extortionate.
Well, when I go climbing, my sighted climbing partner spends a lot of his time audio describing the beauty of the remote places that we find ourselves in. Did you find yourself describing to Sparky what you were seeing?
It was one of the big lessons for me. I remember at one stage, I'm sure Sparky will remember this, and we were having a tough time. Sparky was saying how isolated he felt, and I realised that I'd not fulfilled that part of, my responsibility to describe what was going on. I was getting a bit head down, getting on with what we were doing. As soon as he mentioned that, I went, right, open the hatch when you're off, talk to me all the time and I'll describe stuff. And almost immediately after that, or certainly the same day, there was this bit where I'm sat, I was cooking food, actually talking to Sparky, and over his shoulder, I watched a huge flying fish jump out of the water and a bird, literally. It was like a dogfight between a flying fish and a bird over Sparky's shoulder, and I was describing it to him. And believe it or not, the fish managed to evade the bird that was trying to take it out. It was a perfect example for me. I should have been describing things like that more often during the row, but at that point, it became how important that giving that audio report of it is to Sparky.
And was that sense of isolation the worst aspect that you felt, Sparky? Did you feel very much that any physical reference points had been taken away from you, or did you get used to it fairly quickly?
No, I wouldn't say I got used to it. At the very beginning, there was a lot of issues with me and being on the boat. The first one was navigation. I had two talking compasses, but because the weather was so extreme, it just didn't stand up to the weather. And within 2 weeks, they were destroyed. So consequently, whenever I did my two-hour stint, Mick would have to describe which way the wind is coming, tell me what position the flag was at, like it'll be at 7 o'clock, keep it at 7 o'clock. And that was how I generally rode, with the wind against my face, trying to look at a flag. But as the trip went on, the flag started to deteriorate and it was more difficult to see it. So I really depended upon my wind on my face to know which way to row. Because a lot of people commented on, why were you and Nick zigzagging all the way? Well, that was basically because of my rowing, for those that followed us. But another important point is that Nick did come to life at one point, and one night I saw a spectacle, probably the second best I've seen in my life. He said, Sparky, come out here now, quick. I'll turn the navigation lights off, just sit back here and just look up. And because there was no light pollution, all I could see was like the cosmos up there, twinkling stars and lights everywhere, because I've got peripheral vision, but no macula. Mm-hmm. So it was just amazing, all this beautiful light. I second it to the Northern Lights when I was a young Royal Marine. I spent hours on sentry just staring up, not looking for the enemy, but just looking at the beautiful sky. And that's something that I treasure. And another thing was this great big sunfish came alongside. If Mick hadn't been out there at that time, I would not have seen that fish. It was huge. And am I right in saying that you said it was prehistoric?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's like it's one of those dinosaur, well, the relics of the dinosaur age that are still wandering around the ocean. Yeah, they're the strangest looking creatures and the only thing on the ocean slower than us, really.
Yeah. Don't be like, that's harsh. It was amazing. And another thing, like, if Mick hadn't have been out, it was just coincidental that Mick was out probably cooking at the time when it came by, else I would have been on my own and missed it. So there must have been other things that I missed, but another one was when that turtle came up and started nibbling at the side of the boat. You know, I wouldn't have seen that until Mick pointed it out, and I was leaning over the foot and he was trying to film it, as it were, underneath us. It was amazing. An amazing experience. And of course, on the negative side, plastic, you know, which the Pacific's plagued with, and we actually came narrowly close to rowing over a discarded massive fishing trawler net with a great big orange blob in it. And Mick said if we'd have got caught in that, we'd have been in serious trouble. And it was extremely large from what Mick described to me. And so that was like a negative side of the row. You know, why are people doing this? But all in all, yes, some fantastic experiences.
The book is out now in print and ebook, and I believe you're limbering up to record the audiobook, Mick.
I am, hopefully with you guys. I've been in contact with you guys to offer my services as a narrator. To have a story of Sparky blind rowing across the Pacific and not have it on audio would be criminal in my view. Like, it'd be a real shame.
I couldn't agree more. And you enjoy telling your own story. I know many people who've seen you speak, and I can only imagine that you're going to take the bull by the horns with this and give us a very entertaining read.
I hope so. I was very nervous of it, if I'm honest. It was such a responsibility, because really I was telling two other people's stories. I mean, I'm a common thread through it, but it's not really my stories. It's two very good friends, very important stories. They were both effectively, well, in Sparky's case, abandoned by the system, and they slipped through the support net that was there. So it's a very, very important story, I think, to be out there so that we don't let other people fall through the net again. And I was very conscious of the responsibility I had to tell that story accurately and honestly. So hopefully the responses I've had so far is that it's a good account. So that's all I care about, really, that it's a good representation of those guys, incredible blokes that they are, what happened to them and how they've overcome it. We departed at 5 p.m. to take advantage of the strong southeasterly land breeze, which generally sets in at the end of the day in the bay as the land cools and the wind sweeps down from the hills and out to sea. The waves were choppy but manageable, and we were able to hold a course just north of west out and away from Monterey Bay. We took it as a good omen when several whales surfaced for air near us as we left Point Pinos Lighthouse, the mark on the southernmost headland of the bay behind, and entered the Pacific Ocean. 12 hours later, that helpful southeasterly land breeze had backed all the way round to an unhelpful northwesterly. It didn't stop us completely, but it slowed our speed and pushed us south as we tried to make progress west. Within the next 24 hours, this unhelpful wind built to near gale force. The waves took on the fierce granite complexion I'd seen so many times before as they grew steadily with the increasing wind speeds. The wind chill matched the bitterly cold sea temperatures, and ominously threatening slate-grey clouds stretched past every horizon. "I don't seem to remember you mentioning this in your description of the Pacific in the coach house, Mick," Sparky shouted above the noise of the wind as we swapped over at the end of his two-hour shift. We were both dressed in our full anti-foul gear, as we had been since departure. We were also both cold, soaking wet as a result of the constant hits we were taking from the large waves regularly washing over us, again, as we had been since departure. "It'll get better every day," I assured him, laughing. I said that every day from the day we left. It didn't.
It is a story of two epic adventures, but it is also a story of Sparky and your other rowing partner, Steve Grenham, who you kayaked around the Falklands with, and about both of them dealing with life-changing events and actually bearing their emotions.
I think the single thing about it is you get put people in a challenging situation where they're trying to achieve a goal, and they can talk to each other, and more importantly, talk to guys who speak the same language. And we all basically have a similar history, as well as being friends, and we speak the same language. So you start to talk. I think it's particularly with Steve Grenham, with the issues of PTSD, that was fundamental in his recovery, that he was talking about stuff that he was internalising. But again, with me and Sparky, the things we discovered both ways, I'm sure. You know, I discovered so much about the reality of losing your sight, as much as, you know, Sparky probably discovered about rowing, because he was a very good rower by the end.
Just a bit.
So, do the two of you have another project waiting for when COVID allows us all to go out and have fun again?
We've got another project week after next, haven't we?
Here's a funny one for you, Red. Straight after the project, I was supposed to go back to do the Yukon River with Mick, and I was invited through Blind Veterans to return, go down to Atlanta and work with the Rangers. But what nobody realised was when we came out of Hawaii and flew back to the United Kingdom from Los Angeles, I'd overstayed my ESTA. I'd been there for more than 3 months. So the immigration people were quite happy to wave me through, but the ESTA computerised system didn't. So when I was due to return, I was banned from America. So I was unable to go back and do those two events, which was quite sad, really.
You see, the Pacific is just out there trying to foul you both up at every step, isn't it?
Yeah.
It seems like that.
Oh, well, I am delighted that the two of you have put the Pacific a little bit more in its place and had an epic adventure and discovered so much about each other and different ways of seeing life. Thank you both so much for coming onto the radio station and sharing your epic adventure, and I'll look forward to speaking to you both again soon.
Likewise. Thanks very much, Red.
Thanks, Red. It's been a privilege, mate.
Never Leave a Man Behind, written and narrated by Mick Dawson, is available from the RNIB Library. For more information, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999. And Mick will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
We know just how important reading can be for everyone, whether that's to keep you busy or just to put a smile on your face. The RNIB Reading Services online library is here for you. Register for an account at readingservices.rnib.org.uk and start reading straight away. Browse and download from our growing collection of over 30,000 talking books, newsagent titles, and even sheet music on your smartphone, tablet, computer, or other reading devices. RNIB Reading Services allows you to keep your books until you're finished, and there's no need to renew. Get talking books in DAISY format, enjoy a selection of eBraille books to work on an electronic braille display, such as the Orbit Reader 20. Search for RNIB reading services online or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and tell them you're interested in the reading services library or any other of the great RNIB services we offer.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come today, The Moth and the Mountain, the extraordinary true story of one man's determination to fly to the Himalayas and climb Everest. But first, at the 2019 Wigtown Book Festival, Robert Kirkwood and I met two authors who had overcome trauma by journeying into the wilderness. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Richard Fraser, but first, Sarah Jane Douglas was at Wigtown discussing her memoir, Just Another Mountain. It tells the story of how her mother's death from breast cancer and a message that she left to keep on going no matter what spurred her on to walk the Munros of Scotland and cope with her own diagnosis of the same disease 20 years later.
You grew up in the Highlands and you were saying that your mum introduced you to walking and mountaineering at quite an early age.
Yes, I was about 4 or 5 years old. Well, we had walked obviously before that. I would just tail her along the beach, but there was a small hill at the front of our family home and she used to take me up that, and I loved it because it was just myself and her, and climbing up one of the various threads of sandy trail, we reached the top of the hill and it was just myself and her, the wind in our hair and the world at our feet, and I just felt as free as a bird.
And she was a single mum, and that was, I suppose, the time that you felt closest to her, when it was just you and she and the natural beauty of the area around Inverness.
Yes. I mean, I was always looking for ways to be closer to my mum. I was like her little shadow. And so when we walked together, that was our special time together, and that was, you know, how we bonded.
After she died, you were saying that you had some pretty dark times, but going out and climbing the Munros was your way of dealing with the grief and reconnecting with life.
That's right. You know, when you're on a mountain, you're so preoccupied with route finding or just looking at the beauty of the landscape around you, or you're aware of weather changes, you're distracted from problems that otherwise overshadow daily life. You know, these issues seem to melt away. And for me, being on top of a mountain, you know, I become a much better version of my own self. You know, I'm competent, I'm in control, I know what I'm doing, and I like that because I'm not like that in my real life.
And where did that drive come from?
Oh, a little bit of everything, I think, because obviously mum was who introduced me to walking, and she was the first person to take me up to the top of a hill. It was something we had done together. Going out makes me feel reconnected to her, even though she can't be with me anymore.
Later you found a journal that was kept by the man who would have become your stepfather had he not died in the Himalayas on Nupsi, and that led you on a kind of pilgrimage to climb the mountain that claimed his life.
Yes, so reading his journal revealed the true depths of my own mother's character, and I actually came to accept her life as well as her death. And Mum and Jerry were meant to marry in June 1975, but 6 weeks before their marriage, he fell to his death from the summit couloir of Mount Nupsi, which is a part of the Everest chain. And it was at that point of, you know, reading about Mum and his love for her, and although they couldn't be together in life, I thought I would reunite them in their death. And so I decided to take Mum's ashes out to Nepal and take her to find Jerry and scatter her ashes there to be with him.
You grew up in the Highlands and you were saying that your mum introduced you to walking and mountaineering at quite an early age.
Yes, I was about 4 or 5 years old. Well, we had walked, obviously, before that. I would just tail her along the beach. But there was a small hill at the front of our family home. And she used to take me up that. And I loved it because it was just myself and her. And climbing up one of the various threads of sandy trail, we reached the top of the hill. And it was just myself and her, the wind in our hair, and the world at our feet. And I just felt as free as a bird.
And she was a single mum, and that was, I suppose, the time that you felt closest to her, when it was just you and she and the natural beauty of the area around Inverness.
Yes. I mean, I was always looking for ways to be closer to my mum. I was like her little shadow. And so when we walked together, that was our special time together, and that was, you know, how we bonded.
After she died, you were saying that you had some pretty dark times, but going out and climbing the Munros was your way of dealing with the grief and reconnecting with life.
That's right. You know, when you're on a mountain, you're so preoccupied with route finding or just looking at the beauty of the landscape around you, or you're aware of weather changes, you're distracted from problems that otherwise overshadow daily life. You know, these issues seem to melt away. And for me, being on top of a mountain, you know, I become a much better version of my own self. You know, I'm competent, I'm in control, I know what I'm doing, and I like that because I'm not like that in my real life.
And where did that drive come from?
Oh, a little bit of everything, I think, because obviously Mum was who introduced me to walking, and she was the first person to take me up to the top of a hill. It was something we had done together. Going out makes me feel reconnected to her, even though she can't be with me anymore.
Later you found a journal that was kept by the man who would have become your stepfather had he not died in the Himalayas on Nupsi, and that led you on a kind of pilgrimage to climb the mountain that claimed his life.
Yes, so reading his journal revealed the true depths of my own mother's character, and I actually came to accept her life as well as her death. And Mum and Jerry were meant to marry in June 1975, but 6 weeks before their marriage, he fell to his death from the summit couloir of Mount Nupsi, which is a part of the Everest chain. And it was at that point of, you know, reading about Mum and his love for her. And although they couldn't be together in life, I thought I would reunite them in their death. And so I decided to take Mum's ashes out to Nepal and take her to find Jerry and scatter her ashes there to be with him.
Another author I met at the Wigtown Book Festival was Richard Fraser, a Scottish minister with sight loss, who relates his pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela and the spiritual effect of his journey in his book Travels with a Stick, a story of both vulnerability and inner strength.
My name is Richard Fraser, and I've just published a book called Travels with a Stick, which is basically, partly at least, the story of a walk that I did from the Puy-en-Velay in France to Santiago de Compostela. In other words, what often people call the Camino de Santiago, or the Chemin de Saint-Jacques, if you're in the French side. And it's partly the story of my walk, but partly it's also a bit of a reflection on 30 years of being a minister in the Church of Scotland and recognising that that Christianity, I think for the best part of its entire life of 2,000 years, does a huge amount to fail ordinary people. I found that in opening myself to strangers in their kindness, I learned a lot of things. For example, right at the beginning of my walk, I set off a wee bit like a greyhound out of a trap, and I was very competitive. I got incredibly wet on the first day of my walk. It was absolutely torrential rain. I got really wet, and by 3 days in, I'd walked nearly 100 kilometres, and I had terrible, terrible blisters. And then I met a man who was called Jacques, who ministered to my feet. And he saw the state that I was in, and he offered to help, and he helped me. And I realised that after 30 years of being a minister, that I'd been incredibly self-reliant throughout my time, I discovered a bit about my own vulnerability, and it was a kind of lesson in life, and allowing yourself to be helped by a stranger. I said to the guy the next day, you know, I came on the Chemin de Saint-Jacques, but I didn't expect to meet Saint-Jacques. And so there was that kind of thing. And then, you know, just so many people that I met on the way just taught me so much, you know. And there was kindness. It felt like people were angels, like Jacques was a kind of angel on the way. But also, you know, I met people who said, well, you know, I'm not interested in religion anymore, but I'm deeply spiritual. And so many of the people that I met on the way, sometimes people doing this pilgrimage walk, not because they're religious, not because they were particularly doing anything that might be described as a kind of religious journey, found themselves being changed by the experience of walking, the experience of being immersed in a landscape, and by the experience of meeting people. And what people often say is that you set off to do the Camino, but in fact the Camino does you. Whatever faith is, whatever spirituality is, it is a journey. And there are going to be places where people are are going through dark places, where people are full of questions, where people are not, you know, it's like being in a kind of desert area or in a lush area. Life is like that, you know, it's not. And I sometimes think that our idea that Christianity should be fixed in terms of its dogma, fixed in terms of its buildings, is complete nonsense. And in fact, the early first century church, people called it the people of the way. That's what Christians were called. It was people on a journey. And even in the scriptures, even in the Bible, you know, there are stories of people going on journeys and discovering extraordinary things just by traveling.
Both Sarah Jane Douglas's Just Another Mountain and Richard Fraser's Travels with a Stick are available in print and ebook wherever you buy your books. This is Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to Mick Dawson for the books of his life, many years ago I remember hearing the bizarre story of a First World War veteran who, in 1933, attempted to fly a Gypsy Moth biplane from London to the lower slopes of Mount Everest, and then climb the as-yet-unconquered mountain alone. His story, however, was just a footnote in Everest's history, and no one had really bothered to research it further. But now, award-winning author Ed Caesar has done just that in his book The Moth and the Mountain, which offers a compelling portrait of a man damaged by war and propelled by an inner belief. Before Ed Caesar joins me, here's a clip.
Wilson had been expressly forbidden by the British authorities, both in India and at home in England, to make the journey. The Tibetan government had not given him permission to enter their kingdom, and the British were anxious to avoid a diplomatic incident. If Wilson was discovered at any point on his trek, he would be arrested. He knew he was in most danger of apprehension on the first part of his journey, out of Darjeeling and through the British protectorate of Sikkim, with its leech-infested rivers, verdant forests, and sparkling waterfalls. For that reason, he had paid his hotel bill 6 months in advance to throw the police off the scent. He also planned to leave Darjeeling at midnight in disguise, as a Tibetan priest. Wilson had hired 3 bhutias, Sikkimese men of Tibetan ancestry, to accompany him to Everest. The most senior of them, an experienced climber and porter named Tsering, helped him into his outfit. The disguise was dazzling. A Chinese brocaded waistcoat in gold, with gold buttons at the side, which Wilson thought made him look like a circus trainer. Dark blue cotton slacks, a bright red silk girdle. To finish the look, Wilson wore a fur-lined bhutia hat with large ear flaps to cover his white man's hair, dark glasses to hide his white man's eyes, and he carried a decorative umbrella. Somewhat ruining the effect, he also wore a pair of hobnail boots. Huge, high, heavy items with nails driven into the soles for extra grip. A ludicrous outfit. Wilson loved it.
Chris Dyer narrating The Moth and the Mountain, written by Ed Caesar, who joins me now.
Welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Moth and the Mountain is a really compelling story of a rather beguiling character. Could you introduce us to Maurice Wilson?
Absolutely. Maurice Wilson was born in 1898, and he was the son of a Bradford mill owner. He fought in the First World War with incredible bravery. He won the Military Cross there. And like many other veterans of that conflict, never quite recovered from what had happened to him on the Western Front. His period after the war was spent in a kind of restless mania, traveling all around the world, New Zealand, Mozambique, Canada. And he became very unhappy and very depressed. And a big idea that he thought could save him was to become the first person to reach the summit of Everest. And he hit upon this idea in 1932. He left England in 1933 in a Gypsy Moth biplane, which he intended to fly all the way to the Himalayas. And then to get out of the plane, having landed it near Everest, and then to scale to its summit on his own. It was an absolutely bananas plan, but it was born out of this restlessness, sense of not being able to find purpose. So it's really a story about escape, and his life is a very strange life in many ways, but his story is really born out of trauma, not finding a place in the world, and then doing this wildly expressive and interesting thing to try and overcome those problems in his life.
And the amazing thing is that he taught himself how to fly, obviously with the help of a flying instructor, but he wasn't a natural flyer. He certainly was no mountaineer. He'd been to Snowdon a couple of times, but he was rather frowned upon by the upper class dominated alpinists who were attempting Everest at the time. And yet he had phenomenal self-belief and a good streak of Yorkshire bloody-mindedness.
I think that's absolutely right. There is no doubt he is an eccentric. He is also such a formidable human being. Anyone who can walk from Darjeeling to the foot of Everest, carrying much of their own gear, having never crossed that terrain before in their lives, is a hardy specimen. You know, he did it in a little over 2 weeks, which is an extraordinary lick that he got there. He overcame so many problems. He overcame the complete opposition of the civil service, both in England and India, to his mission. They tried to turn him back at every stage. He hoodwinked them. He got fuel when he shouldn't have done. He outwitted emissaries of the British Empire wherever he found them. You know, he was in so many ways just a very admirable person. In other ways, perhaps, you know, his treatment of women, his personal life, less admirable. But certainly he broke the mold, and there aren't many people in history like him.
As I said in my introduction, I had heard of him before, fairly much as a footnote in other Everest adventures. But because he was an outsider, he was frowned upon. And I think it's rather a shame, because you look at some of the other eccentric adventurers through history, Patrick Leigh-Fermor and people like that, who, even though they were a bit bats and broke the rules, are lauded as great heroes. And yet, for the most part, poor Maurice Wilson has just been ignored as a crank.
Yes, and that was a big motivation for me in writing the book. I felt that he'd been written off from almost the moment that he set foot on Everest. The Everest parties of the time in 1933 and 1935 found him very strange and his motivation very strange. Even if, at least in the 1935 party, they admired his courage. After that point, when Everest was eventually scaled successfully in 1953, his story was resuscitated again by a British journalist named Dennis Roberts, and there was this short book written about Maurice Wilson called I'll Climb Mount Everest Alone in 1957. And that book is quite condescending towards Wilson. And I feel like that sets the narrative around him forevermore. I was motivated, in a sense, by reading that book and thinking, well, there just must be more to the Wilson story than this. He wasn't just a hapless eccentric with strange ideas about the world. People don't decide to fly their planes to Everest and then try to climb it on their own on a whim. There has to be something deep pushing you there. So I wanted to, if not reinstate him to his rightful place, at least to show the world what had driven him to do something so extraordinary. And I hope that I've achieved that.
And as you point out in the book, you're not alone in holding him in quite some esteem as far as his endeavours are concerned. One of the greatest mountaineers of all time, Reinhold Messner, who was actually the first man to solo Everest, which is what Wilson was trying to do, holds him in equal esteem.
Yeah, that was a remarkable discovery for me. Messner's an interesting and difficult character himself. Hard-bitten, very dismissive sometimes of other climbers, a vast personality. And he wrote this beautiful book called The Crystal Horizon, which describes his solo of Everest in 1980, in which Wilson plays an outsized role. Very high up on the mountain at 26,000 feet, Messner is lost in a waking vision about Wilson, thinking, God, if Wilson had got up here, I think he would have made it to the summit. And Wilson serves as a kind of spiritual talisman for Messner. Messner admires Wilson's doggedness. He says he's tougher than I am. All the qualities that Wilson possessed, all of his best qualities, Messner wishes he had more of, which is quite something for someone who was the first to summit all of the world's 8,000 meter peaks. And it was interesting. I went out to the Dolomites to meet Messner in his castle in Bolzano, Bozen. And Messner was there with his huge, craggy face and ice blue eyes and somewhat forbidding demeanor. And he really warmed up when I talked about Wilson. And it was clear to me that Wilson had not released his grip on Messner, even after all these years.
That resilience Messner clearly identified in Wilson really comes through in his diary, his notebooks. I mean, he was clearly a man who was fighting some pretty awful demons as a result of the First World War, not only his own injuries, but actually his brother came back with terrible shell shock and never recovered. And yet, I suppose that's what drives Wilson on, that need to prove himself, to feel alive rather than lead a half-life.
I think that's right. A friend of mine, the novelist Andrew O'Hagan, he talked to me after he'd read the book, and he remembered something that his mother had told him, which was that traumas don't happen to one person, they happen to the whole family. And you really get this sense with Wilson that it's not just about what's happened to him, it's about coming back to a city in Bradford that had been ruined by the First World War because so many young men had joined the Pals battalions and so many had not come back. It's a city of widows and darkness and of a wool trade that's fast declining after the First World War. On his street, on Wilson Street, Cecil Avenue, at a certain point in my research, I just went house by house to find out what had happened to the young men in each house. And so many of them had not come back. So many school friends and friends who played sport with the Wilsons, and they were all gone forever. So you're coming back into this changed environment. And in the same house as Maurice Wilson is his brother Victor, who shakes and who has nightmares and who can't work ever again, and who has to go to Blackpool for spells at the seaside under the care of a doctor, having been deeply affected by his service in the two battles of Bull Court in 1917. That's what Wilson comes back to. And I think it's too simplistic to say that Wilson was traumatized. I think the whole city was traumatized. Wilson found it unbearable in the immediate aftermath of the war and got out of Bradford and got out of England and started this period of travel that never really finished. It finishes at Everest. This mania to move eventually finds its way to the Himalayas.
And of course, there are parallels with George Mallory, who was also a First World War veteran, who also felt that need to go into the beckoning silence and find peace in his own head.
It's interesting when you look at how many people in the expeditions of the 1920s had served in the First World War. It's a huge proportion of them. You have veterans of the Somme, you have veterans of Passchendaele, you have people who've suffered in all sorts of ways. And oddly, those missions were somewhat divided between older Brits for whom the adventure felt almost like a Victorian adventure, and younger climbers like Mallory, for whom it was a more modern, more reflective journey, a sort of journey of the soul. Reading Mallory's letters home and his diaries, you do get a sense of someone reckoning with deep currents in their self, I suppose. And for them, as Wade Davis writes in his incredible book, Into the Silence, Everest had become like a sentinel in the sky. You know, you come out of the mud of Flanders and the thing that you're looking towards is this absolutely majestic, forbidding, seemingly unattainable peak shining high in the sky, as much metaphor as it was real mountain.
You clearly took quite a few years researching and writing the book and found more evidence than anyone else has. Do you think there is still anything out there to be found out about Maurice Wilson?
Oh, I hope not. I live in fear. Actually, I don't know whether I hope not. I sort of lived in fear of publishing the book and someone writing me a note the day after publication saying, oh, I've got all these letters you haven't seen, or I've got this diary, or I've got this or this or this. I tried so hard in the years that I researched this book to find everything that there was to find. Archives in three different continents, shipping manifests, old letters. I found a great nephew, a little treasure trove of things in Bradford, things I'd never seen. I really got to the point where I felt like there just can't be anything else left. You know, I felt like I'd got to get. It wasn't everything. And one of the difficulties about writing the book is Maurice Wilson's fame really relates to 2 years of his life. But it's a 13-month adventure, and that's where most of the documentary evidence of his life comes from. And however hard you tried, there were holes in the rest of his account. So you have to work out, as a biographer, what do you do when you can't know something? You can try as hard as you can, but when you can't know something, what do you do? And that was the challenge for narrating this book. And it was one that I hope I solved by being a little bit present in the story of the book, not too much to be obtrusive, but to somehow guide the reader into saying, well, here are things that we can't know.
Well, it is a compelling and beguiling story, which has been beautifully brought to life by Chris Dyer, the narrator, for those of us who can't read the text. You must be delighted with the way that's turned out.
I am thrilled. It has been the thrill of my life to watch something I'd worked so hard on and struggled so hard to fashion and bring to life. To watch it land in this way has been extraordinary. And it's the most warming thing in the world when you open up your computer in the morning and there are 5 or 10 emails from strangers telling you the ways in which they've connected with Maurice Wilson's story. And I hope very much that your listeners feel like they connect with Wilson. He is the most extraordinary character, and now more than ever, I think we all need to escape our physical circumstances because we are stuck for the time being. And Wilson does help you escape.
Before Wilson left the hotel, he wrote a final letter to Enid Evans, his soulmate, and the only person who believed from the very beginning of the adventure that Wilson would succeed in reaching and climbing Everest. Enid was slim, winsome, brown-haired, stylish, vivacious, and married. Wilson was cripplingly in love with her, and not just because of her faith in his mission. She, too, was enraptured by the ebullient adventurer and his wild stories. Recently, their affair had flourished in letters. Now, Wilson was leaving Darjeeling. With no more opportunities to send mail before his climb on Everest, he wrote to Enid for a final time, telling her about his beautiful, absurd outfit and about when he might return from the mountain. He wrote that she would be with him in his thoughts the whole way. Before he signed off, he told Enid, if she were with him, I might let you kiss me. With his letter finished and addressed, Wilson made his final preparations. He carried with him much of his climbing equipment, disguised in what looked like bags of wheat. He had also sewn many pockets into his outfit.
Chris Dyer narrating The Moth and the Mountain, written by my guest, Ed Caesar. Ed, thank you so much for bringing Maurice Wilson back into his rightful place in the public imagination and for being a guest on Read On.
It's been my pleasure. Have a very happy 2021.
The Moth and the Mountain by Ed Caesar is out now in print, ebook, and audio, wherever you buy your books. Now it's back to Mick Dawson for the books of his life.
Mick, is there a book that you read as a youth that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
There was probably several when I look back at it. I can remember being very young and Enid Blyton being a favourite. But if there's one book that jumps out on me and I can remember it at school, it's James and the Giant Peach by Roald Dahl. I was even quite recently talking to somebody about it and how I can remember that story and reading it at school and it having a lasting effect on me. Yeah, it just piqued that interest in reading, and ultimately that seems to have gone on to writing now. So yeah, I'm very grateful. We're lucky in this country, we had some great authors.
Up until this time, he had had a happy life, living peacefully with his mother and father in a beautiful house beside the sea. There were always plenty of other children for him to play with, and there was the sandy beach for him to run about on, and the ocean to paddle in. It was the perfect life for a small boy. Then one day, James's mother and father went to London to do some shopping, and there a terrible thing happened. Both of them suddenly got eaten up, in full daylight, mind you, and on a crowded street, by an enormous angry rhinoceros which had escaped from the London Zoo. Now this, as you can well imagine, was a rather nasty experience for two such gentle parents. But in the long run it was far nastier for James than it was for them. Their troubles were all over in a jiffy. They were dead and gone in 35 seconds flat. Poor James, on the other hand, was still very much alive, and all at once he found himself alone and frightened in a vast, unfriendly world.
James and the Giant Peach, narrated by the author himself, Roald Dahl. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yeah, there are probably several, but there's one brilliant book I read, probably what I wouldn't have chosen, but I picked it up by chance at the time, some years ago now. It's called Wild Swans, Three Daughters of China by Yung Chang. Again, it's a book I probably wouldn't have chosen, but I came across it by mistake, and it's a huge book. I think it's a Pulitzer Prize-winning book, but I remember not being able to put it down. It was just absolutely compelling. So yeah, that's a book I would recommend. It's not a quick read, but it's just a fantastic book.
On the 27th of July 1949, my grandmother, Dr. Shia, and my mother's closest friends, most of whom were under suspicion from the communists, came to the station to see them off. As they stood on the platform saying goodbye, my mother felt torn by contradictory feelings. With one part of her heart, she felt like a bird which was now going to burst out of its cage and fly to the sky. With the other part, she wondered when or if she would ever see these people she loved, particularly her mother, again. The journey was fraught with danger, and Sichuan was still in the hands of the Kuomintang. It was also 1,000 miles away, inconceivably far, and she had no idea if she would ever be able to get back to Jinzhou. She felt an overwhelming desire to cry, but she held back her tears because she did not want to make her mother sadder than she already was.
Dai Langford narrating Wild Swans, Three Daughters of China, written by Zheng Chang. And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yeah, there is. And it's quite relevant as well with the stuff that Sparky and I have done and Steve Grenham. It's a book called Tribe by Sebastian Junger. Sebastian Junger wrote The Perfect Storm, and I had the privilege of meeting him and getting to know him when I was working on a yacht in Cape Cod, where he lives and plays in a local blues band from time to time. And we've become friends, and I bought it's his latest book, or most recent book, and it's about basically when he was embedded with the Air Cav during the Afghan conflict. But he touches on the reasons why particularly combat veterans struggle with reintegrating into Western society. And it's a fascinating book because it not so much points or paint veterans as being damaged from their experience. It just shows what potentially is wrong in Western society that makes it so difficult to reintegrate after the intensity of combat. It's just a fascinating book, and it is a relatively quick read. It's a one-day read, but it just hits the spot on so many things that I've discovered on the stuff that we've done in the Cockleshell Endeavour. It just resonates massively with me.
I eventually got into Sarajevo on a UN relief flight from Italy. Sarajevo had once been a gorgeous Habsburg-era city, filled with cafes, art galleries, and theaters. But now it was sweltering in the July heat and permeated by the smell of burning garbage. Destroyed cars littered intersections where street battles had taken place, and almost every building was spattered with shrapnel. The bombed-out Oslo-Bodjenje newspaper building oozed its guts out a lower floor, as if someone had just pulled a huge plug on the inside. People hired taxis to drive close to the front lines so they could talk by radio to friends on the other side, who were also in taxis. At night, the city was completely, absolutely dark, and you could walk through it as if you were the only human left on Earth. During the day, the streets were filled with people carrying jugs of water or dragging branches for firewood or walking to work in their office clothes, some semblance of life the way it was before.
Nick Landrum narrating Tribe by Sebastian Junger, which is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library. Mick Dawson, thanks so much for sharing your joy of reading with the Read On listeners. And again to you and Sparky for being guests on the show.
Thank you for the invite, Rob.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And we're always available to download as a podcast. Just search your provider for Read On, the audiobook show. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is radio@rnib.org.uk. And you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Red Sail, which is REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. Thanks to all my guests, producer Hannah, and to all of you for listening. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.